Ben's Beefield class that we have back here, some students. Welcome, and we're happy to have you here. And if you want to ask any questions later, we'll be happy to try to answer them, I suppose. I don't know. But it's a good learning experience. The courts are something you don't often see. Legislatures are very public. Courts seem to be very private, even though they're open. So it's good to have you. All right, now we'll hear the last case, Hutchins versus United States Department of Labor. And I understand Mr. Turnage is not going to appear. He's, I'm not sure what the full explanation is, but you're here, Ms. Drake, and what we'll do is we'll receive Mr. Turnage's briefs and we'll have him submit on oral argument and we'll decide the cases, but we'll hear from you if you want anything further and want to argue something.
Thank you, Your Honor. Right. Please support, as you recognize, Beth Drake on behalf of the United States Attorney's Office for the District of South Carolina, representing the U.S. Department of Labor. Plaintiff, in her briefing, has complained that the Department of Labor seeks to have this case decided.
It is always the problem that when you stand up to argue against someone who's not here, you might help. If you don't trust your brief, you might just help out their cause. But I'm just, you know, I just throw that out.
Appreciate that, Your Honor.
Interesting that if you get up and there's no one to argue against, you argue.
Recognized and have given that some thought, and I will be brief. Again, the Department of Labor's, the plaintiff has complained that the Department of Labor seeks to have this case decided on the limited facts and issue in this case, and that is exactly correct. We seek to have this court apply the facts in this case to the law and issue, and in so doing, I think the court will affirm the district court. To be clear, the fact pattern in this case does not involve an assignment, which is the logical extension that the plaintiff's counsel would have you apply. Now, I think the court can look to the use of the term person in the assignment statute as relevant, but it should not be the deciding factor in this case. The fact pattern.
The word person has a range of meanings that is quite different in different contexts. Some statutes define person to be individuals as opposed to corporations. Other statutes say persons include corporations and public entities. And we find just a broad range through all the law. And to relate one to the other is difficult. It seems to me the best way to handle this one would be to take this in context as a subrogation statute. And it seems to me that what they're doing is any person other than the United States, is the language here, would mean any source of income from someone other than the United States will reduce the United States obligation. It's the only way you can give effect to a subrogation statute, it would seem. But you can address this and you can argue against it, but.
Your Honor, that is our strongest argument and a contextual argument, and that is certainly the first argument or the first point of law that Judge Childs made a finding in favor of the United States on. It is completely consistent with the Lorenzetti case that speaks to any third party, and to give full meaning to the statute itself would include other governmental entities besides the United States, to include, as in this instance, the town of 96. That is our strongest argument, Your Honor.
Yeah, the other point that follows that fairly closely is that it is a subrogation statute. United States is trying to recover, as is in most state workers' comp laws, trying to recover expenses that they laid out from tortfeasors. And in order to accomplish subrogation, the focus isn't on the particular person, the focus is on another source other than the United States.
That is correct, Your Honor, and that is the point ignored by plaintiff's counsel in making his argument before this court. The subrogee and the assignee the United States would have no superior right to those that it stepped into the shoes of in this instance. So there is no 11th Amendment argument to be made. We can only step into a situation and obtain the rights of that individual. And so you can do, contrary to what plaintiff argues, indirectly, which you could not do directly in this instance. Those are the two strongest points, Your Honor. Certainly those are district court did not reach the 11th Amendment argument.
I don't understand it myself. 11th, this statute doesn't authorize a claim against the city.
That is correct.
It basically says that it can bring one if it could bring it, or that the individual can bring it if it can bring it. But in this case, the individual did bring it and did recover. And so we're just talking about a fight over the money.
That's correct, Your Honor.
$275,000, and the government wants a piece of that.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct.
They've already paid out, what, 400 and some thousand?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah. Okay.
I'll be glad to.
That piece of it, which is it like one-fifth, is that like hard and fast, or and this is kind of just a little extra information I'm trying to understand in terms of segregation here, because do you look at, or is the opportunity for the plaintiff to have negotiated that in any way, or is that negotiated, or is that just hard and fast? Because it would seem to me, depending on who's sued by the plaintiff, here a city, or for someone who is limited in terms of the amount of money, and the city, of course, has sovereign immunity, probably not going to pay much more than what the policy allows or whatever's there, or just because of the city, probably is a limited settlement you can get. Is that a consideration, or is it hard and fast to one-fifth?
There is a formula that's applied, and the formula, my clients are in the room. If we get too deep into FECA law, I'm going to have to, you know, run back here and consult. But it's a formula that's applied and done at the administrative level. It's actually...
My question is that hard and fast, that formula? Is it, do you just do formula and then you don't do any negotiating whatsoever?
It is a hard and fast formula, having looked back and seen the nod of the head of my client agency. And I know that the application of that.
Well, otherwise, the employees would be able to give up money from the FISC that belongs to the United States, and they would have to have some authority from some location that they could negotiate, I would think. If there's a statute that said they shall carry out subrogation rights, then there's a discretionary act, I suppose, in how you pursue it or make litigation decisions. But if they can negotiate a compromise, maybe they can.
They can negotiate a compromise with...
That was Judge Wynn's question.
The third-party tortfeasor.
It comes to my mind, many, many years ago when I was in the Navy, we used to have this thing called a Medical Care Recovery Act. And I recall it seems like there was some room in which you could, you know, work with the plaintiff on it. I guess it was an equitable consideration of, like I say, it depends on the amount of recovery, but you've answered my question. That kind of, and that's an aside, it's not an issue in the case. Thank you.
Thank you. I'll be happy to take any other questions else. I think the court's questions have...
And you can't avail yourself of any lien, can you?
There are... we can't do garnishment, as I understand that the Department of Labor can do garnishment. In this instance now, I want you to understand, we have gotten back from Ms. Hutchins the $87,000 in some odd sense. But had she not paid that over, there are alternative remedies. We don't sue to get the money, but we have garnishment.
Well, if the tortfeasor was a private entity, let's say the Coca-Cola company or something like that, where they had a lot of money, then theoretically she would have recovered a lot more than the $400,000, and the government would have gotten its full $400,000 less 20% or whatever it is, and she would have gotten more compensation. She just happened to be stuck with the fact that the tortfeasor in this case was a city with a maximum liability of $300,000.
That's right, Your Honor, but that's not unlike, I mean, the statutory schemes for torts vary state to state, and they're different formulas, so it's kind of the luck of the draw as to where you get hurt in terms of what you can recover against third parties, particularly in the day of tort reform. But in this case, had she been injured by a private tortfeasor, the South Carolina Tort Claims Act would not have capped at $300,000. So.
Okay.
Thank you.
We'll adjourn court for the day, and then we'll come down and greet you and proceed on.
This honorable court stands adjourned until tomorrow morning at 9:30. God save the United States and this honorable court.